Welcome to PageCast, a podcast series brought to you by Jonathan Bull Publishers, aimed to give you the story behind the story. By interviewing the authors responsible for some of your most loved books, we explore the thoughts, ideas, emotions, and creative processes that led to the writing of these books. If you're a reader with a zesty interest in people and stories, do stick around and enjoy what PageCast has to offer. It is lovely to be with you today. My name's Feriel Hafiji. I'm a journalist and editor, and I'm so excited to have with me here Mark Kafusa, one of South Africa's renowned authors. I thought I might just say at the start, Marky, that what I love about Mark's work, his political writing, is that it is so fine and it's so refined. And it pays real respect to the archive. It's deeply researched. And it's absolutely fair, and that's what makes reading him such a pleasure. I find that his political reporting is of such a standard that it really makes me look at everything else with quite a critical eye, because too often do I find that our political reporting today is about the intricacies of a feudal ANC politics that means less and less to you and I. So I really love how you do your craft, and I want to honor that today. So let's talk about this book, Thabo Mbeki, The Dream Deferred. And here's its genesis. So what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode? That's by Langston Hughes, and it's where Mark draws his title from. Marky, very welcome, and congratulations.
Thank you so much. I love that she calls me Marky in public.
Sorry.
And it really says something about those words are very beautiful coming from you, Feriel, because we've walked such a path together, and I have such huge respect for you. I mean, I think about three moments in particular in our relationship. The first is when we met at the Weekly Mail when I was I was just back in South Africa as a young journalist, and Feriel was a trainee, and it was in a moment of such incredible excitement and hope for the promise of what our new society might bring. Our friendship continued, but the next moment I want to put my finger on was the launch of the first edition of this book, which was in 2007, just in the run-up to the Polokwane conference, where Thabo Mbeki took on Jacob Zuma, or Jacob Zuma took on Thabo Mbeki, and Zuma won, and it was a time of unbelievable ferment, and you were one of the people interviewing me in the Great Hall, and we had 2,000 people in the Great Hall, and it was alive, it was bristling.
It's quite a moment.
Because no one really knew what was going to happen in our country, and it just said something about where we were then. There was a lot of anger at Mbeki as well, and also anger at me, because I was seen to be on Mbeki's side, because I'd written a biography of him. I have a different way of looking at it that we can talk about. And then sort of fast forward to now, and here we are in the Congregational Church. It's a little bit calmer today than it was.
It is.
But I feel like we're at another pivotal moment. I really do. And in a way, the section I'm going to read now talks to that. 3 months after the July 2021 insurrection, Thabo Mbeki went to eThekwini, its epicenter, on the campaign trail for the ANC in the local government elections. Addressing an audience of black professionals and entrepreneurs, he noted that one of the causes of the insurrection had been the serious crisis in both the economy and service delivery. This was, he said, a reflection of the ANC's failure, that was Mbeki's word, in government. He spoke of the economic recovery plans developed by both the business sector and the government, and expressed his strong opinion that the blockage in moving forward came from government inertia, or inefficiency, or incompetence, or aversion to the private sector. Something is wrong there. And Mbeki said about the government that was run by the party for which he was campaigning. Of course, course, such commentary needs to be weighed against a subtle agenda present in much of Mbeki's recent commentary. Things went wrong after you threw me out. But notwithstanding the ways these problems have roots in his own presidency, Mbeki's truth-telling is very important and strangely underreported, as much of his post-presidential life has been. The effect of the insurrection on South Africa seems, as with Marikana or the Fallist insurrection, or any number of smaller acts of violence over service delivery, to be paralysis or entropy rather than collapse or explosion. Despite the flash fire explosions, often violent and destructive, post-apartheid South Africa exhibits some of the other consequences of the dream deferred, suggested in Langston Hughes' poem. There is the sagging of a bureaucracy under the heavy load of patronage that is the curse of African politics, in an environment where the state is often the only employer and where jobs are often dispensed rather than earned. There is the rotten stench of corruption and the way it was for too long covered up, in the first instance with the multi-million rand arms procurement deal put together by Mbeki when he was deputy president. There is the sugary crusting over of dreams with the conspicuous consumption of tenderpreneurs, blinged up political operatives who follow in their insouciance the example of their wealthy white compatriots. Nothing symbolized the way South Africans lived beyond their means more than the image from the July 2021 looting of a man caught on television loading Woolworth's groceries into his large Mercedes Benz. Alongside this, of course, there is the ever-deepening inequality, the festering sore of poverty due to the country's economic crisis, an unemployment rate of 35%, a crime epidemic that makes South Africa one of the most violent societies in the world, and most recently the COVID-19 pandemic that has served to bring this inequality into such sharp relief. The first years of democracy brought South Africa an unprecedented period of economic growth, albeit without commensurate employment growth, and the unexpected gift of political stability. But the ideals of this era have dried up, like so many raisins in the sun, as the nation's leaders have revealed themselves to be not the demigods of struggle mythology, but as flawed and as self-serving as any. One verse in particular has stuck with me from Langston Hughes' great poem cycle, and I found myself repeating it almost as an incantation. From river to river, uptown to down, there's liable to be confusion when a dream gets kicked around.
Thank you very much, Mark. I must say, I don't know about you and you've written about it, but July 2021 and what President Cyril Ramaphosa calls a failed insurrection felt like an insurrectionary moment to me. And it's interesting that Thabo Mbeki, who turns 80 this year, is enjoying such a resurgence or resurrection or what you call a redemptive act. But yet it's been happening quite under the radar. It's under-tracked and under-reported. Tell us more about how you understand. Is he back there out of his own, by his own hand, or has the ANC redeployed him, called him back into service?
Look, I'm so glad you said at the very beginning of this that neither of us are interested in ANC feudal politics.
I'm really not.
And the days are long over where I spent, hours of my life running after people saying, chief, tell me what's going on. So I must say at the outset, I don't have any inside intel, right? And I also made a decision, for reasons I'm happy to talk about, not to engage with former President Mbeki when writing my new epilogue and introduction to this book. So what I'm telling you is my inference.
Sure.
On the basis of research and thinking. I think it's accurate to say that after Thabo Mbeki was chucked out as the ANC president and then as the president of the country in 2007 and 2008, he suffered some kind of breakdown. Was it a nervous breakdown or a political breakdown? I don't know. I'm not close enough to say. But that breakdown, I write quite a lot in my book about how his favorite Shakespeare character is the Roman war hero Coriolanus, who is expelled from Rome. Coriolanus, excuse me, who's expelled from Rome because he won't play the vainglorious leader. And as he leaves, he says to the people, "Oh, you common cry of curs, I banish you. There is a world elsewhere." And that to me says something about, I mean, a little bit of Mbeki's contempt for us. You know, he was president of the country for many months before he was recalled, and he was absent. I mean, particularly around that xenophobic violence moment. But it also says something about his hurt. And we have to remember that he was expelled by, it wasn't his political party, it was his family. And this is really one of the big themes of my book, the way Thabo Mbeki constantly has tried to balance being a member of a family or a leader of a family, the patron of a family, and the patriarch of a family, and the leader of a political party, and how those get confused. So he did disappear. And in fact, he was accused of being one of the people who founded COPE, the opposition party, which became the place where the Mbekists went. And to try and smoke him out, Jacob Zuma wrote him a letter, which was leaked, in which he said, I'm really interested to see that you're not campaigning for the ANC anymore. And Mbeki said, I will not rule from beyond the grave. I will not have anything to say about South Africa or about the ANC. And he was making it a sort of act of nobility, but I really think it was a sign of hurt. I mean, a little bit later, he said he was asked by, I think, Given Mkari in a radio discussion, do you have anything to do with the government? And his reply was, why would they want what I have to say? They chucked me out. They hate me. That was his attitude. Now something profound shifted in 2017. When there was the leadership crisis about Zuma, and it seemed very clear that Jacob Zuma would remain in power through his proxies. And Mbeki had gone against Zuma, right or wrong, in 2007, because he was convinced that, he was convinced, vainglorious, I would say, that he was the only person who could stop Zuma's corruption, because he already knew about Zuma's corruption and Zuma's ineptitude. He knew it very well. As did we all, of course. So we, all of us who thought, yay, the Mbeki era is over, there's a new opening now, all of us sort of carry some responsibility for looking the other way and not really looking at what was in front of us with Zuma. That being said, Mbeki was convinced by elders in the ANC to speak again. And he did. And he started speaking before the 2017 leadership conference, very powerfully at a meeting of veterans in November 2017, where he spoke about how this corruption he was seeing was not the ANC. And that's interesting, because it's one of the things I try and interrogate critically. Is it not the ANC? Was Mbeki just saying that because he was trying to say, the people who chucked me out are not the ANC, when really it was the ANC? So he started speaking then, and then very interestingly, given his history with Cyril Ramaphosa, who was his arch foe in the ANC for many, many years, and that's a whole history I tell in the book, Ramaphosa brought him back into the party in interesting ways. And Ramaphosa, I understand, I say this having said that I don't really follow gossip in the ANC anymore, Ramaphosa spends a fair amount of time at Mbeki's Rivera house.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, seeking advice or bouncing things off. Now, that doesn't stop Mbeki from criticizing.
So it becomes a part of his many kitchen cabinets. You know, yeah. Ramaphosa runs things by a series of kitchen cabinets.
This is one of them.
Okay.
I understand. I stand corrected, but I understand, sir. And since Ramaphosa's come into power, he started campaigning for the ANC again, and he's sort of been given a job within the ANC, I think, driven by Ramaphosa, as elder statesman, mediator. Most recently, he went to try and make peace between warring factions in the Free State. And he's really become a voice, a powerful voice, and we can interrogate the hypocrisy of, maybe hypocrisy is too strong a word. He's become a powerful voice against corruption, against state capture, and he reminds us every time he speaks that he has been against this, and the ANC, the good ANC, because he splits the ANC into a good and a bad, has been against corruption since the very beginning. And that's the role he's playing, and whatever I might have to say about him that's quite harsh in this book, I think it's a really important role, and I'm really glad he's playing it. It's good to have his voice back. But it's interesting that it's back in a way that's not amplified. And maybe you have some thoughts about that, because you work in the media, as to why we don't hear him. I mean, to me it's a bit like we need him to be the spectral presence. You know, some of us loving him as the founder of the African Renaissance and black economic empowerment, and just wanting to be remember him as all that's good, and maybe others of us just really still incredibly angry with him because of HIV, because of Zimbabwe, because of the way
because of Bikoli,
because of whatever. Mm. So yeah.
So I think one of the reasons we haven't picked up on this important resurrection or return of Mbeki is because there's so few political reporters, Mark, that we even find it difficult to cover this rapidly fracturing political environment with the rise of your Gayton McKenzie's at the Patriotic Alliance with Herman Mashaba's action essay. It's so new that we haven't watched this return of Mbeki by President Cyril Ramaphosa. I have noted that he does sit in on all the ANC NEC meetings, even by Zoom. So you have former President Zuma and Mbeki in all these meetings, these two very opposing forces. I do want to pick up on something the former President Mbeki this time has been saying, and he says, the ANC is too big, too important to fail, and if it should fail, the country will fail with it. Now, I want to speak about that a little bit, because I'm not so sure that that's the situation any longer. That increasingly the ANC, which has played such a huge role in our recent history and, of course, for the past 100 years, I don't think it's the force that it used to be. And in fact, the November 2021 election has shown us that it's on its way out. And that what I think is going to happen in the 2024 election is that President Cyril Ramaphosa will still be president, but he'll be the head of a coalition government. And the ANC will increasingly become a rural-based party like your ZANU-PFs, like other liberation movement-based parties. But why would he say such a thing, Mark? Why does he still believe, against all data, that the ANC is too big to fail?
Well, let me say at the outset that when I say what I'm going to say, the colors of my new book might look like the DA colors. I had nothing to do with that. I like to think they're the colors of the Ukrainian flag. It's a
which means Mbeki's like a Zelensky character?
It's a symptom of... It's on a continuum with Jacob Zuma saying the ANC will be in power until
Jesus
the second
comes.
Millennium. It's a deep sense of manifest destiny. It is our right to rule this country. We are the only ones who can rule this country, and this is the ideology that it has its roots in Marxism-Leninism, which, and of course, remember Mbeki, certainly more. Well, both Mbeki and Zuma were schooled in politics. I mean, Mbeki by his father, Governor Mbeki, and then as a leading member of the South African Communist Party in exile. It's absolutely in his political marrow that only the ANC can govern. And I wonder if... I mean, he was... I write in my book that he didn't join COPE because... he felt these familial bonds too strongly to the ANC. His own mother joined COPE. But it's not just that. It's really just this deep-rooted belief that it's the ANC's right to govern. And that really is the ANC's problem. And I totally agree with your analysis. But I think lodged in what Mbeki's saying is something of a threat. A gentle threat, but a threat nonetheless. And it's a threat about the chaos that happens in coalition governments. It's a threat about the chaos that's happening in Johannesburg or Pretoria, and how that threat might be, how that chaos might become national if the scenario you are predicting becomes true.
It's interesting.
So, yeah, that's what I think is going on there.
Because what you have in Cape Town, I saw the lovely young mayor, Jordan Hill Lewis.
Oh, is he here?
Not here, but oh. I saw you on Twitter, is what he calls a functional federalism and a decided attempt to by the DA to try and win at least three provinces in 2024. But we won't go there yet. I want to stay for a moment with what you pick up on in your book as a deep nostalgia for the Mbeki years. Mm-hmm. And you note that it's mostly young people who believe that he was the guy, that it was a much, much better time. And to be honest with you, Mark Markey, is I feel sometimes when I've covered the kleptocracy of the Zuma era and the past 3 years of the Zondo Commission, we are as kleptocratic and corrupt a country as Italy and Nigeria and the worst of the examples in the world now, the Stans. And I have felt that his time was deathly for the people who... For the mothers and children who died from AIDS, but that it was not so deeply corrupt. So yeah. I kind of understand the nostalgia.
Yeah, me too. It's also a nostalgia that I share for heightened political discourse, right? I mean, I personally wasn't always down with that discourse, certainly when it was used to deny... that HIV causes AIDS. And it was an ideology that was used to deny that. It was an Africanist ideology that was used to deny that.
A little louder, please.
I also see how that discourse was often very corrosive. And that's one of the reasons why so many people, and particularly minorities, breathed a sigh of relief when Mbeki left, because there was a racializing discourse that made many white and brown people feel like they weren't African enough. I'm not leveling any comment about that, but I'm saying that was out there, very much so. But all that being said, there was a heightened political discourse. I mean, it's not just the sort of endless quotations to Yeats and Shakespeare, which could sometimes sort of become sludge. We were governed by ideas. And they might have been the right ideas or they might have been the wrong ideas, but they powered the way this country was governed. And that ended. That really ended after Mbeki left. So that's one place of the nostalgia. The other place of the nostalgia, and listen, my evidence that young people hold to this nostalgia is anecdotal and personal. It's what I see about the people who approach me about the book, or who write to me about the book, or who tweet about the book. And I have noticed that they tend to be young, black professionals and intellectuals, many of whom were not even necessarily around during the Mbeki years. And I write about... I have some ideas in my epilogue as to why that is. But it must be in part... And people in this room can tell me more. I don't want to speak on behalf of anybody. There are people in this room who might have clearer ideas about this. But the sense I get from having spoken to people that it has to do with the way Mbeki's, the way he articulated the need for black excellence and what was behind the African Renaissance. And really the way his policies, the implementation of his policies created in record time a black middle class in this country.
Yes.
Undeniable. Extraordinary. And too often when people criticize black economic empowerment, including Thabo Mbeki's own brother, Mweletsi, who's one of the biggest critics, they talk about the way there've just been a few billionaires made and everybody else has been left in the dirt, the increasing inequality. They talk about the way this has enabled corruption, the way black BEE was put into practice in South Africa has without doubt enabled corruption. I can talk about that more, I write about it in the book. But what's forgotten is that the tens, the hundreds of thousands of people, bank clerks, medics, university graduates, professionals who have been able to work towards achieving their ambitions as a result of Mbeki's policies. And that's where I think a lot of the nostalgia comes from. Now, the second part of your question is the more critical part, which is that can we be nostalgic for a time that was less corrupt? Yes, I agree with you. We can, no question. And Ivor Chipkin and his team, who wrote a really important book called The Shadow State, draw a vital distinction between the political capture that happened during the Mbeki era and the institutional capture that happened during the Zuma era. And the political capture was about making sure the ANC was in every single little corner of the bureaucracy so that it could achieve its ends, which is, you know, the upliftment of South Africans on paper. Institutional capture was, that's not good enough. We need radical economic transformation, and the way we're going to get radical economic transformation is by using state institutions, particularly the parastatals, the SOEs, because we have power over them. And we're going to use these as vehicles for radical economic transformation. Again, I mean, Pravin Gordhan, a big believer in that, huh? A good guy.
This is
even more than the developmental state, because the developmental state started under Mbeki. This is taking the developmental state to a new level, which is to say, let's use everything we've got, including our SOEs. And what I want to say is that under both political capture and institutional capture, shit happened. Both in their different ways opened the doors for the kind of kleptocracy that the Zuma era brought. And what I track in my epilogue in particular is the way, I mean, it's not like a line was crossed when Zuma came into power and suddenly we were in the era of state capture. The expression I use is that the Mbeki presidency set the table for state capture. And we can talk about the various ways that he did.
Let's talk about it now.
But yeah, I mean, I think that is correct.
So I think you ask a fabulous question here. Was the ANC captured by corrupt outsiders who ejected Thabo Mbeki from power and destroyed his legacy? Or is Mbeki himself an author of the misfortune that befell South Africa following his dismissal? Not just by facilitating Zuma's rise to power, but by presiding over an earlier era of patronage and putting into place a particular set of policies and practices that set the scene for what would follow.
Yeah.
That was setting the table. Give us a couple of examples of how you argue that.
I don't have the time to go into all of it here.
Just a few.
More in my book. But the first thing I say is promoting Zuma to be his deputy president despite early evidence of incompetence and moral laxity. And that was a political decision. I need this man on my side. Well, they cost to political decisions. And then later, of course, he facilitated Zuma's rise to power because of the way Zuma became the anti-Mbeki. If Mbeki was the aloof Coriolanus who had banished his people, Zuma was the everyman. You know, I'm like you. I also have appetites. I'm not a clever black. I'm a man of the people. And Mbeki is very much part of that that kind of binary that got set up by Zuma. But in more tangible ways, I mean, The black economic empowerment policies that were set up, I mean, are essential for all the reasons I've given. But they were ripe for abuse. Because as Mweletsi Mbeki said to me correctly, when you make your money because of who you know, rather than because of what you know, that's ripe for corruption, particularly in an environment where the political party, maybe because it's a ruling political party and it has to, is living beyond its means and constantly needs funding. So to the extent that Mbeki is culpable of the kind of corruption that leads to state capture during the era of his presidency, I think that most of it revolves around the funding of the ANC, whether it's the Oilgate scandal, which happened under his watch, whether it's the arms procurement deal. There's no evidence of it, unfortunately, because back then we didn't have party political funding legislation. But Andrew Feinstein reports, and I totally trust him, he reports in his book After the Party that he was told clearly, stay away from the arms deal because it's funding our party. Did Mbeki know that the arms deal was funding his party? How could he not have? And if he didn't know, then it's omission, sin of omission rather than commission. Then there's Chancellor House, right, which happened under his watch. Chancellor House is this ANC investment vehicle that did a sweetheart deal with Hitachi that supplied the boilers for Medupi and Kusile.
Which don't work very well.
I mean, we know how that story ended, don't we? Right? And as the anti-corruption investigator Paul Holden says, as a governance issue, that stinks. Because the ANC is torn between the health of its bank balance and the power that it goes to its people. And, you know, that is very problematic. And that's from the Mbeki era. Finally, I think that he set the table. Well, two more things I'd say about setting the table. One is what we call in sometimes a lazy shorthand cater deployment. But this Marxist-Leninist democratic centralist notion that you implement policies through cater deployment, and that your ideologues no more than your technocrats. Now, that's not across the board, partly because of Mbeki's own ideology around economic policy. That's not necessarily hard worked in the Treasury, where the technocrats governed and still govern. So it's a mixed picture. There wasn't this attempt for total political capture as there was under the Zuma era, an attempt for total institutional capture. But there certainly was abuse of state organs and of presidential power, I would say, I would argue, for party political reasons or personal reasons. And the two examples I mention in my book is, the first is the allegation, which is controversial, there are two sides of the story, the allegation that came out during the spy tapes that Mbeki had a hand that was illegal in the charging of Jacob Zuma. And the second one, which to me is more damning, is his role in the Vusi Pikoli Jackie Celebi affair, which I'm happy to talk about a bit more if we have time, or it's in detail in my book.
Yeah, no, because, I mean, that sets the table for the almost complete corruption of the National Prosecuting Authority, the defanging of the scorpions into the much less effective hawks. And on credit deployment, as Spence always tells me, is it's been totally corrupt because ESCOM, for example, you have no electrical engineers on the board anymore, and you can apply that same thinking across. You understand why our SOEs have all but died. Yeah. In Johannesburg, where I love, where there's at any given time 40 to 50,000 potholes, it's because they have a guy called Republic Monakedi from Limpopo in charge of the roads. He's such a corrupt man. All you had to do was Google him to see that he was the wrong cadre to deploy. So you can see how these policies have been corrupted over time. What I have noted, Mark, sitting at the Zondo Commission, is that in the Mbeki era, the arms deal up to a number of the first big corruption scandals, that flow of the purpose of it was to fund the ANC in that triangular relationship, tenders to companies, sympathetic companies, and then funding into the ANC. What happened with the Guptas is that second loop gets diverted toward Dudu Mayeni, the Jacob Zuma Foundation, so it becomes much more individualized, kind of Filipino corruption, whereas before it would go to the party.
Look, there were those such diversions.
Sure, to the sheikhs, etc.
There was John Modise. There was Jackie Salabi. But no, that's a different story. I guess that's different. But there were such diversions, and we have to remember that the initial diversion that happened to Jacob Zuma from the sheikhs happened when Zuma was put there into that arms deal by Mbeki to play a certain role. So there were not diversions that we know of into Mbeki's pocket that we know of. And nobody has put any evidence on the table, even any prima facie evidence on the table yet. But yeah, there were diversions, but they were piecemeal. They weren't. I mean, the reason why
the reason why
we can use kleptocracy to describe the Zuma presidency and not the Mbeki presidency, because that was the purpose of the Zuma presidency.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's pretty clear now from many bits of evidence. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of PageCast. We have an incredible lineup of author interviews. So head over to our Facebook and Instagram and follow Jonathan Ball Publishers to stay updated and in the know regarding future episodes. Thanks for your interest in the story behind the story. Happy reading from everyone at PageCast.